And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fight side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting and talking down to me. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fight beside me. Just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in a part that I need. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. And you're running down my country, man. You're walking on right beside me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program. Here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com at AltTV.com. Anyway, lots more news and views. And this is an item I really should have mentioned yesterday. And that's yesterday, the 10th, was the feast, the Jewish feast, I guess you'd call it, of Purim. And there's a lot of misinformation out there about that, and I'd like to clarify. And it's a rather serious, and it shows a contrast between Judaism and Christianity. Many of Christianity's major feasts are feasts celebrating life or renewed life. For instance, Christmas, that hated feast, celebrates the birth, a birth, something positive of the Redeemer, Jesus Christ. Easter celebrates the conquest by Jesus Christ. Of death. He, of course, died, he was crucified, but he rose again, and with all the implications. Well, many Jewish feasts are nowhere near as positive. This will give you some very good information about Purim. And most of this is from Michael Hoffman, a tremendous researcher into Judaism. The rabbinic feast of revenge. And see, that's kind of interesting. I'll be contrasting that a little bit later as to the way it is often presented.
begins today, that's March the 10th, that would be yesterday, at sundown and concludes March 11th. This Talmudic Kabbalistic rite, only nominally tied to the Book of Esther, is a pottage of bloody vengeance and pagan occultism. On Purim 1994, Israeli settler Baruch Goldstein, who'd been born in the States, massacred 40 Palestinians while they prayed at Hebron at the mosque, which is also closer an important Jewish temple. Israeli police forces under supposedly liberal Prime Minister Ehud Barak then shot to death a few dozen more Palestinian civilians in the subsequent protests. These murders are largely forgotten, and the casualty figure from Goldstein's slaughter was reduced by the media from the actual number of deaths, 40, to the number repeated frequently since then, and that's 29. Goldstein has even been declared tzaddik, or saint, in some sectors of Israeli public opinion, and celebrations of his mass murder are held at his grave annually during Purim. And over the years, Michael Hoffman has published a number of very powerful essays on Purim. Purim partly derives out of the accusation that Jews had dual loyalties, and this was from their time of exile. Purim is the rabbinical festival of revenge derived from the Book of Esther, and then further embroidered and extended by authoritative Talmudic and Kabbalistic traditions, which are observed in Orthodox Judaism as a sacred obligation. Purim is celebrated as a festival commemorating revenge upon non-Jews. And this is kind of interesting. I just lost this for a moment. We do have our problems with computers, don't we? Purim is celebrated as a festival commemorating revenge upon non-Jews. Pious Judaic believers dress in various grotesque Halloween-style costumes and regalia. Much of it is reminiscent of the reversals common to the medieval festival Feast of Fools, whereby persons of low station masqueraded as aristocrats and aristocrats as peasants, villains as saints, and alleged holy people as demons. Consequently, on Purim in New York, this writer, that being Michael Hoffman, has witnessed Israeli-Americans dressed as Arab suicide bombers, complete with ersatz bomb belts, and rabbis attired as women, gorillas, and clowns. There are deeper meanings attached to Purim than reveling in vengeance against one's enemies, real or imagined. They are largely outside this side note. He says, Purim entails a perverse obligation for the Judaic male to become intoxicated. He is to become so drunk on Purim that he can't discern the difference between Mordecai, that's the Judaic hero of the Book of Esther, and Haman, that's the villain of the book. In other words, Judaic males are to become nearly blind drunk on Purim. The Talmudic injunction for this behavior is found, he cites the passage, the esoteric reason for this intoxication, which produces a perception of the union of opposites, that is, of good and evil, rests on further Kabbalistic doctrine, which is the occult secret of Purim, that both Haman and Mordecai serve the purposes of Judaism. As the eminent rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch explains it, anti-Semitism is the tool through which the God of Israel preserves his people. That seems to be saying that anti-Semitism, well, unites Jews. On Purim 1994, Dr. Baruch Goldstein, an Orthodox Talmudic Israeli from Brooklyn, took a machine gun into the Cave of the Patriarchs in the Palestine city, Palestinian city of Hebron and massacred 40 Palestinians while they prayed. The media have engaged in massacre denial and reduced the number of those murdered to 29. He has a shrine in his honor in the Israeli state. The ninth degree of Scottish Rite Freemasonry, dedicated to revenge on Masonry's enemies by beheading, is inspired by Purim. On Purim 2001, the late Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia aided and abetted as his numerous activities on behalf of Talmudic training for U.S. lawyers and his own statements testify the imposition of Talmudic or Halakha law in America. The first documentation and writing that we have of this ominous fact is a letter he dated March 9, 2001, written on Supreme Court stationery, pledging support to a rabbi of the Shabbat Lubavitch sect of Christ haters. These are very, very radical Orthodox Jews. Was it a coincidence that Judge Scalia chose to pen his letter to the rabbi on Purim? On Purim 2003, George W. Bush, the Skull and Bone Society snake who Scalia helped make president of the United States, launched the invasion of Iraq during Purim, which resulted in the catastrophic decimation of Christianity in that Arab nation and deaths of tens of thousands of non-Jews. Interesting that bad things happen at Purim, and that was one of the results of George Bush's war in Iraq. Essentially, the Chaldean Christian minority at one point, about over 1.5 million, have been reduced to just a handful and driven out. In Purim week 2016, approximately 35 hours before the beginning of Purim on March 23rd at sundown, more than 30 Gentiles were slaughtered at an airport and subway station in Brussels, Belgium. Perhaps it's a coincidence that the mass murder and the subversion of the U.S. Constitution, the invasion of the nation of Iraq, and the terror slaughter in Brussels all occurred on or near Purim. But again, perhaps it's not, he says. In another article, Michael Hoffman says, Esther is a problematic book even without rabbinical counterfeiting. It seems to have been written in a void. God is missing from its pages, and Jesus never quoted Esther. The name Esther is derived from the Hebrew Nistar, which denotes hidden. We consign the book of Esther to the category of a mystery. The rabbis chose to add to it significantly, as is their custom with regards to the book of the Hebrew Bible, just making things up as they go along. According to their Midrash on Esther, she was married to Mordecai. Quote, not only was Esther an upright Jewish woman who abhorred the notion of marriage to the Goy, or that is to the non-Jewish king Ahasuerus, she was actually already married to Mordecai, who was the greatest sage, that's the master of the oral law of his generation. Every time Esther went to Ahasuerus, she was literally taken and forced to be with him. Through her marriage to Ahasuerus, Esther still remained loyal to her true husband, Mordecai. After leaving Ahasuerus' presence, she would immerse in a mikvah, or ritual bath, and then secretly rendezvous with Mordecai. Well, she basically prostituted herself out to the Babylonian king. The preceding convoluted fabrication is typical of the Talmudic perversion of the biblical narrative. Overview states that Mordecai took Esther as a bat, or that's a daughter. The rabbis claimed that bat actually meant bayit, or home, a euphemism for wife. Similarly, the absurd wordplay in the Babylonian Talmud is used to prove that the mother of David's opponent, the giant Goliath, was addicted to anal sex. On Purim, it is necessary for the Judaic male to get drunk. He is to become so completely drunk that he can't discern good from evil. A quote from the Talmud, no longer distinguish between Arur, Haman, that's the cursed Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Baruch, Mordecai, or blessed Mordecai. And then he then, in this article, has some film footage of drunken Jews on or Jewish males on Purim. One of the foods served on the holiday of Purim are Haman's ears, baked in the form of pastry. Like a human ear. Well, it's pastry, of course, but who would eat an ear? In the Kabbalistic understanding of this custom, as personified by the Hasidic sage Rabbi Zvi Elimelech of Gino, the hearing of knowledge, not authorized by the rabbis, and which emanates from, is a spiritual danger. This is a quotation: consuming the ears of Haman at the Purim meal symbolizes eliminating wicked opinions, the evil da'at, which is represented by the hearing ears. This is particularly a spiritual threat posed by Amalek, who is the progenitor of Haman. It's also the threat posed by Jesus Christ, who said, "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." In the Zionist-influenced media, it is the Catholic priests and pulpit-pounding Calvinists who are made to represent heresy hunting, and the tolerant and loving rabbis in their communities who are depicted as the targets of the inquisitors, never the other way around. This is a reversal of the actual reality that Jesus spoke of in Matthew chapter 22, verses 30 to 39. The religion of the Talmud and the Kabbalah is an anti-biblical occult system. On Purim, the adherents of these texts dress Halloween style in all manner of grotesque attire. In 2013, New York State legislator Dov Hikind, is a big noise in the Jewish community, that mocked black people by dressing in minstrel blackface and an Afro wig. Every October, Protestant fundamentalists vigorously protest and warn against the observances of Halloween, but these faint-hearted folk have few words of protest or warning about Purim. Anyway, there's a lot more, but that gives you an idea of that Purim was a celebration of revenge against the king. I draw this to your attention because we're going to have a very different take presented on this right now. Here's a story, it's very interesting, on the day that it's published. And this happens to be about a home of a man who once lived in London, Ontario. It is datelined Purim. Now, that's not the way the mass media put it. It is datelined London, Ontario, March 10th, which is the beginning of Purim. London's Jewish community is celebrating the demolition of a home many thought to be a symbol of hate. The infamous so-called Nazi house just west of Hyde Park in London, Ontario, is being torn down. For Rabbi Catherine Clark of the Shalom on the synagogue on Huron Street, it's a long time coming. Quote, "Today is a very important Jewish holiday called Purim, where we celebrate a victory over hatred from 2,500 years ago." It was a celebration of revenge. A celebration of over hatred. Esther basically whored herself out to the Babylonian king. I think we should... just be quite clear about this, because a lot of nonsense is put out. In the Bible, Esther was the cousin of Mordecai, a member of the Jewish community in during the exile period, who claimed she was the orphan daughter of Mordecai's uncle. This was during their Jewish exile in Persia. She becomes the queen of Persia and thwarts a genocide of her people. The story forms the core of the Jewish festival of Purim. And in this, King Ahasuerus, the ruler of the Persian Empire, holds a lavish 180-day banquet, initially for his court and dignitaries, and afterwards a 7-day banquet for all the inhabitants of the capital city. On the 7th day of the latter banquet, Ahasuerus orders the queen, Vashti, to display her beauty before the guests by coming before them wearing her crown. She refuses, infuriating Ahasuerus, who on the advice of his counselors removes her from her position as an example to other women who might be emboldened to disobey their husbands. He then makes announcement, arrangements to choose a new queen from a selection of beautiful young women throughout the empire. Among these women is a Jewish orphan named Esther, who was raised by her cousin Mordecai. She finds favor in the king's eyes and is crowned the new queen, but she does not reveal her Jewish heritage. Shortly afterwards, Mordecai discovers a plot by two courtiers to assassinate Ahasuerus. These conspirators are apprehended and hanged, and Mordecai's service of the king is recorded. The king then appoints Haman as his viceroy. Mordecai, who sits at the palace gates, falls into Haman's disfavor as he refuses to bow to him. Haman discovers that Mordecai refused to bow on account of his Jewishness, and in revenge plots to kill not just Mordecai, but all the Jews in the empire. He obtains Ahasuerus's permission to execute this plan. And Mordecai discovers the plan. He goes into mourning and implores Esther to intercede with the king, but she's afraid to present herself to the king unsummoned, an offense punishable by death. Instead, she directs Mordecai to have all Jews fast for 3 days and vows to fast as well. On the third day, she goes to Ahasuerus, who stretches out his scepter to her to indicate that she is not to be punished. She invites him to a feast in the company of Haman. During the feast, she asks them to attend a further feast the following evening. Haman is again offended by Mordecai, and at his wife's suggestion, has a gallows built to hang him. That night, Ahasuerus cannot sleep and orders the court records to be read to him. He is reminded that Mordecai interceded in the previous plot against his life and discovers that Mordecai never received any recognition. Just then, Haman appears to request the king's permission to hang Mordecai, but before he can make the request, Ahasuerus asks Haman what should be done for the man that the king wishes to honor. Assuming that the king is referring to Haman himself, Haman suggests the man be dressed in the king's royal robes and the crown and led around on the king's royal horse. A herald called, see how the king honors a man he wishes to reward. To his surprise and horror, the king instructs Haman to do so to Mordecai. Overcome by rage, Ahasuerus leaves the room. The king promises to grant her any request, and she reveals that she's Jewish, and Haman is plotting to exterminate her people. Unable to enforce a formal royal decree, the king instead adds to it, permitting the Jews to join together and destroy any and all those seeking to oppress them. This particular day, Haman's 10 sons and 500 other men are killed. Upon hearing of this, Esther requests it to be repeated the next day, whereupon 300 more men are killed. Over 75,000 people are slaughtered by the Jews, who are careful to take no plunder. Depending on whether you consider Esther Mordecai's wife or not, she basically was whored out. And you see her working for her people. So this is then presented. Now this is back to my story about the destruction of the so-called Nazi house in London, Ontario. The rabbi, the female rabbi, says, "Today is a very important Jewish holiday called Purim, when we celebrate a victory over hatred 2,500 years ago." Well, victory over hatred. It would saw the massacre of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of Persians. That's supposed to be a religious feast? So, anyway, the rabbi continues. "So my first thought is it's a shame that people keep trying to perpetuate hate and make it a force in their lives. But I'm glad that the house is being demolished so that we can have a fresh start from here. The home was built 50 years ago by original owner, self-proclaimed Nazi." Well, he didn't say he was a Nazi. He was a National Socialist, Martin Weich. I knew him. "To resemble one of Hitler's retreats. It was given the name Berghof. Weich died in 2011. Now, the Berghof was one of Hitler's retreats in the Bavarian Alps. The home has since been popular with those interested in documenting abandoned buildings. Quote, he obviously had no use for anyone who wasn't Aryan, recalled former CFPL-TV news director George Clark. It was Good Friday, 1973, when Clark, a young reporter at the time, was invited by Weich himself to a party at the house to celebrate Hitler's birthday. He remembers about 30 to 40 people in attendance, including Ku Klux Klan members." Did they say they were members of the Klan, I wonder? "Hell's Angels and other National Socialist supporters." The text here says Nazi. He said those in attendance celebrated by burning a 20-foot-high swastika. Well, that's an old Celtic custom from the Highlands of Scotland, and that's why the Klan in the United States lights a cross. It's an old folk tradition. Our folk, actually. And it's more properly referred to as lighting a cross, not burning one. Anyway, this reporter, news director, who was then a reporter, "Well, I was astounded that existed in London, and we knew nothing of it. And this was before we had calls from neighbors about burning items there. But this was my knowledge that such a place existed. And it was on the edge of the city. Hyde Park's a quiet little community. You don't expect that." Oh, boo-hoo-hoo. Anyway, the house has apparently long been abandoned and is now being demolished. And notice what the rabbi says. It had become a symbol of hate. What's this, a house? In fact, long abandoned since Martin Weich died 9 years ago. You really do have to... the mass media, you really do have to watch very carefully. Joe Felici sent me a link. they call it Purim, and it's a holiday celebrating Gentilicide. That's us. And there's a link to The Ugly Truth at WordPress. So I click on that, and what do I get? TheUglyTruthWordPress.com is no longer available. This site is being archived or suspended for a violation of our terms of service. So this information is now suppressed. Isn't that interesting? And this is something... this sort of censorship goes on. I think we've got to be very aware of it, and I think we've got to call it every time we see it. We find our access to truth compromised. And you see, without other sources, you might well believe that very let's say, benign explanation of Purim given by the rabbi. And of course, that will fly as long as nobody knows any different. And that's why preserving the internet is so vitally important. This is entitled, I'm Enraged and You Should Be Too. How Ignorant. And I turn now to Fox News' Tucker Carlson. And this is about drugs and our dependence on, my God, the Red Chinese. How did that all come about? And the next voice you'll hear is Tucker Carlson from Fox News. Now, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me. This is Tucker Carlson. Extortion from China is the real threat. We're trying to get this up for you here.
Good evening and welcome to Tucker Carlson Tonight. There comes a time in every presidential administration when the people in charge realize they're not really in control. Unforeseen events arise. In an instant, every assumption about the future changes. Heads of state die, wars erupt, natural disasters descend, epidemics rage. None of it was in anybody's plan. There's something about human nature that prevents us from preparing for this, for abrupt and radical change. We pretend the unexpected will never happen. But there's something in nature itself that reminds us it inevitably will. It's always a terrifying realization. The rise of the Chinese coronavirus is that kind of moment. The virus is quickly becoming a global pandemic. Ultimately, it could kill millions. At the very least, it will reorder the global economy and change our politics. Could the disease help determine the outcome of our next presidential election 8 months from now? Of course it could. In fact, it will. Our leaders can't stop that. Like all matters of life and death, it is beyond human power to affect. But they can respond to the threat in a way that makes this country stronger, not weaker. How can they do that? Here's how. The first step is to take the virus seriously and to convince the public that you are. In 1918, Woodrow Wilson's White House downplayed the Spanish influenza and refused to take obvious precautions to slow its spread. Wilson had a pointless war in progress in Europe to fight. His generals couldn't be distracted from that goal. So the government continued to ship men to overcrowded army camps across the country to pack them on ships to France. The virus spread exponentially. In the end, about 53,000 American soldiers were killed in combat in that war. At least 675,000 Americans died of the flu. Could Wilson have prevented that disaster? Well, not entirely. But by early and decisive action, he could have improved America's odds. So what does effective action look like now? Well, we ought to be screening people when they get off the planes from infected countries. That's not complicated, it's obvious. But at the same time, it is hardly a solution. We should be honest about how much we can do to keep the Chinese coronavirus from coming here. 100 years ago, the Spanish flu killed a significant percentage of the population in remote Aleutian Islands, and that was before air travel. Today, the entire world is connected by hourly international flights. Global pandemics are inevitable. There's too much movement to keep viruses isolated. We should acknowledge that. Yes, we can do our best to keep foreign diseases out of this country, but we ought to spend most of our time trying to figure out how to protect Americans once the diseases get here. There's still a lot we don't know about the Chinese coronavirus, but two things do seem clear. It is highly communicable, and the elderly and people with pre-existing respiratory disease face the greatest threat from it. That means for most Americans, the biggest risks will come not from the virus itself, but from its ancillary effects. People will panic, travel will be disrupted, markets will tumble, and, most critically, hospitals will be overwhelmed. We're about to learn the limits of our healthcare system. Conditions will be tough for the many thousands of Americans looking for beds to recover from the flu. In Seattle, they already are. But things will be even worse for anyone suffering from, say, pancreatitis or a burst appendix, not to mention countless other health emergencies. People like this may not get care at all. Our system won't be able to accommodate them. There are many implications of this, and some of them are political. For example, is this really the time to invite the rest of the world to join Medicare for All? Probably not. That idea was always stupid. Now it's clearly dangerous. On a practical level, saving American medicine from collapse must be our leader's top priority right now. We need to expand emergency hospital bed capacity. We need to make certain we have enough life-saving drugs and medical equipment, the basics. Unfortunately, that's not as simple as it sounds or as it should be. Well, the rest of us who are arguing about sexism and transgendered bathrooms, China took control of our healthcare system. China dominates the world market in pharmaceutical ingredients, compounds used in virtually every essential medicine for high blood pressure, for cancer, for Alzheimer's disease, and many more, come from China. So the key components in vital medical technology, CT scanners, X-ray machines, ultrasound. As of tonight, more than 95% of all the antibiotics in America are manufactured in communist China. 95%. Our chief global rival has a total monopoly on the most important medicine in the world. That should worry you more than anything the candidates are currently talking about. Imagine watching one of your children die from an infected cut. China has the power to make that happen. The Chinese government is acutely aware of this power. Last year, a prominent Chinese economist suggested cutting off the supply of antibiotics to the United States as leverage in the trade war. That should have been the biggest story in America. The news media all but ignored it. Why? Because it implicated them and their political party in one of the greatest crimes of our time. 9 years ago, famously brilliant former President Barack Obama did predict a connection between China and the next global pandemic. Unfortunately, Obama got it backward. He claimed China would help us.
I absolutely believe that China's peaceful rise is good for the world, and it's good for America. To the extent that we have a partner in addressing issues like climate change or pandemic,
our foremost genius. The people in charge have no idea what they're doing, and to the extent they do, they're selling us out on purpose. We should have seen this coming. In recent weeks, you've heard a lot about disruption to our so-called supply chains. Think about what that means. It means that thanks to economic changes that made a small group of business moguls incredibly rich, we no longer make the things we need to survive and prosper as a nation. People who hate us and who seek to displace us make those things. And it's not just medicines and X-ray machines. It's computers and phones and robotics and automotive components and machine tools and essential parts for aircraft engines, etc. In fact, apart from fossil fuels, it's almost everything. And now you may have noticed many of our leaders are talking about shutting down our domestic energy sector, the last independent part of the American economy. This is sabotage, and we're about to learn how undermined we've been. At some point, our leaders should be held to account for this. For now, we need to work as if our lives depended on it to fix this problem. Global warming isn't the existential threat we face. Extortion from China is. In very real ways, the Chinese government controls us. There is no greater national security danger than the one they pose. To respond, we need a modern Marshall Plan, one designed to rebuild essential American manufacturing. We should start tomorrow with medicine and technology to fight the coronavirus, and then with antibiotics. Some will oppose the idea because it poses a threat to arrangements they currently benefit from. But a majority of Americans will welcome it gladly, even in the Congress. Manufacturing lifts every congressional district. It shouldn't be hard to win bipartisan support. No doubt the sages on television will denounce any acknowledgement of China's threat as racism or intolerance. Joe Biden's already done that. Ignore them. The Chinese coronavirus really is Chinese. It arose in that country for the same reason American businesses have sent so many of our jobs there: lax health and safety standards and endemic corruption. China did this to the world, and we should not pretend otherwise. That's not xenophobia, it's true. The most bitter irony of all of that is that a few years from now, when every last victim of this virus has recovered or been buried, the Chinese government could easily grow stronger because of this disaster and America weaker. China unleashes a pandemic and then overtakes the U.S. as a result? That's too horrible an outcome to contemplate and too dangerous for us. We ought to do everything we can to make certain it does not happen. Well, let's start by accurately describing what is happening. The Chinese coronavirus isn't some fluke of globalization. It is the inevitable byproduct of it. Exotic diseases and the mass destruction they cause are the built-in cost of connectedness, and they always will be. The people who told us there was no downside to living in a borderless world were lying. Make them eat their words. Strip them of their power. Never listen to them again. In fact, and this is still the hardest thing for official Washington to accept, this pandemic vindicates Donald Trump's entire political thesis. On the big things, Trump was right. Trade, immigration, manufacturing, globalization. These are the issues our ruling class assiduously ignores and has ignored for decades in favor of silly, calculated distractions like gender warfare and race politics, things that divide us. Trump, by contrast, ran on the issues that mattered, and he won. precisely because the public was tired of being lied to, and he should remember that. The White House reaction to coronavirus so far has been uneven and limp, but it doesn't need to be. The blueprint for an effective response, a response that not only protects this country, but improves it, is right there in the president's 2016 acceptance speech at the Republican convention in Cleveland. Americanism, not globalism, will be the credo, he said. We're going to start building and making things again. All we need to do is start believing in ourselves and our country again. It is time to show the world that America is back, bigger and better and stronger than ever before. There it is. That's the governing agenda in the age of the Chinese coronavirus. Abandon globalism, rebuild the country, make the things we need. A strong America is an independent America. There's no other way.
And that was Tucker Carlson. Really shocking information. Here is a commentary sent my way along with the story. The communist government in China controls us because our pathetic government under the Obama administration, and with the Republicans sharing some of the blame, let our pharmaceutical companies manufacture 95% of our antibiotics that we use go to China. Now that's called putting all your legs in one basket. And Tucker Carlson in the commentary gives the prescription for salvation. That's bring manufacturing back to the United States, or as Donald Trump put it, put America first. Well, this is Paul Fromm. You're on the fighting side of me. Play a little bit of our culture. We hear a lot about Jewish culture and Purim in the show today. This is from this is a CD sent to me by Mark and Tina Palazzolo in St. Louis, Missouri. They're were longtime active members with me in the Council of Conservative Citizens, and these are some Ulster Scots tunes that were brought over to the New World by Ulster Scots, who settled a lot of Appalachia.
Some do ecstasy or cocaine, that's what they do to lose their brain. Some do marijuana, some do dope, but that's what they do just to cope. But no, not us, where we come from, we just do the lambeck drum.
The lambeck drum, the lambeck drum, we just do the lambeck drum.
Some do LSD for their fix, hallucinations just for kicks. Some do tabs to get up high, and some do jabs to reach the sky. But no, not us, where we come from, we just do the lambeck drum.
The lambeck drum, the lambeck drum, we just do the lambeck drum.
Some do vodka, wine or whiskey to get them feeling fine or frisky. Some run for miles to escape and jump up and down to get in shape. No, not us, where we come from, we just do the lambeck drum.
The lambeck drum, the lambeck drum, we just do the lambeck drum.
Some folk roar and some folk rant to tell all the people just what they want. Aye, some folk rant, some folk roar, tell the people they want more. No, not us, where we come from, we just do the lambeck drum.
The lambeck drum, the lambeck drum, we just do the lambeck drum.
Thank you.
station. The Fleural Stern marched away, and off they went for king and empire. The song took all their blood and life. Their mothers greeting, the feathers drinking. A moo a widow, the mare a wife. It's powerful quid in Craigie Warren, but wished my wind falls in the night. His feathers lying, we poppies blooming. That wee cub was his heart's delight. I'll rear the wind that has nae feather, and tell them a' the lads say lail. They'll sing and play and raise a ruction. The dun will heal us powerful weal. I mind the lads of Craigie Warren. I mind the lads of yin and aw. We cheered them off at Fenner Station. The Fleural Star marched
Thank you.
Gorillawa.
This is Paul Fromm, and back with you again tomorrow, same time. Sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.
In days of yore, from Britain's shore, Wolfe the dauntless hero came and planted firm Britannia's flag on Canada's fair domain. Here made to wave our host our pride, and joined in love together. The thistle, shamrock, rose entwine, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. And Lundy's Lane, our brave fathers side by side for freedom, homes and loved ones dear, firmly stood and nobly died. And those dear rights which they maintained, we swear to yield and never. Our watchword evermore shall be the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen and heaven bless the maple leaf forever. Dominion now extends from Cape Race to Nootka Sound. May peace forever be our lot and plenteous store abound. And may those ties of love be ours which discord cannot sever, and flourish green o'er freedom's home, the maple leaf forever. The maple leaf, our emblem dear, the maple leaf forever. God save our queen.